House of 89.
There's a path over there. Do you know where it goes?
Oh. Yeah, that's a good story. A good walk. I'll take you up there sometime. Tell you the story, too.
Thanks for tuning in to Class of 89 on the Fangoria Podcast Network, where we take you behind the scenes of our favorite movies that turned 30 this year. I'm Natasha Pasetta, your host and vanguard of the vault over here at Fangoria, and this is the second episode of our series on the original Pet Sematary movie from 1989. Our guest today is Carlene Hirsch. Carlene was the film's lead greensman. For those who aren't in the movie biz, a greensman's role in a film is exactly what it sounds like. A greensman manages every aspect of on-set greenery, including live plants, fake plants, and plant-related props. Every leaf counts in a movie. We'll talk about Carlene's unique role, the real pet buried in the fake pet cemetery, drinking Budweiser with Fred Gwynne, and so much more. We'll get to Carlene's stories in just a minute, but first, I want to tell you about Fangoria Magazine. Fangoria Magazine is back and better than ever in a deluxe 100-page quarterly edition. Each issue includes set visits, deep dives, new discoveries, and minimal ads, all printed on collectible-grade paper stock that reimagines the classic magazine for a 2019 audience. You'll see familiar names like Michael Gingold and Tony Timpone, and you'll see bylines that will leave your jaw on the floor, literally, like Barbara Crampton. And the best part, it's print only, just like the old days. Go to Fangoria.com to subscribe today. And I want to tell you about our friends at Cavity Colors. Cavity Colors is a horror brand from Atlanta, Georgia, with a monstrously huge variety of officially licensed shirts, enamel pins, patches, and more. They have modern favorites like What We Do in the Shadows and Creep, as well as all-time favorites like Evil Dead 2, Halloween, Candyman, and Return of the Living Dead. They've got great new collections for 2019 like Starship Troopers, Night of the Living Dead, Trick or Treat, and much more. You can use the promo code FANGO, that's FANGO, FANGO, for 20% off your entire order. So visit CavityColors.com and get some new horror merch for yourself. Visit CavityColors.com, where every day is Halloween. Now, let's see if the ground is still sour with Carlene Hirsch. You had a really interesting role on Pet Sematary. You were the lead greensman. Explain to our listeners what that role entailed.
I was in charge of all the exterior sets coming out the way the production designer and the art directors intended them. And that's about it. So anything outside that you see, trees, grass, leaves, plants, fences, rocks, that's all my jurisdiction.
Well, the outside, the exteriors play such a huge role in Pet Sematary. Yeah. They are characters in of themselves, and we'll get into that in a second, but you're a Maine resident. So what did you think when you first heard that Pet Sematary was going to be shooting in Maine, and were you a Stephen King fan at the time? What was it like when you first heard they were going to shoot there?
I had already worked on Creepshow 2. We filmed that in 86, or part of it.
Oh.
We did the interior sets of the Wooden Head series. It's built like a three different cartoons,
right,
out of the Creepshow magazine. And that was my first movie for Stephen. And I knew Stephen and Tabitha prior to that. Stephen taught at the University of Maine as a grad student while he was writing, I think, Salem's Law and Carrie. Mm-hmm. At the time, and he and Tabitha had, I was a theater major, and he had come to a couple of the shows, and we had talked, and it was funny, I was working at the Deckhouse Dinner Theater down in Bass Harbor, and I got a call there from the location manager, and I thought it was a prank, so I hung up on him, and then it was Stephen that called back, and I recognized his voice, and he said, "Don't hang up. I'm handing you over to somebody." And that I got hired on the telephone for doing the exterior sets, well, for set dressing on Creepshow 2 was my title. And I dressed, everybody would prepare the set, and then I would come in and dress it out to give it the feel and the character. And so that's how I first got into film. And then from there, the director, Michael Gornick, was asked by Paramount Studios for Pet Sematary. They called Michael and asked him who he would recommend for helping with getting things rolling up here in Maine. And I got a call from Ralph Singleton, who was the executive producer on Pet Sematary. And he asked me if I wanted to interview for a job, and I said, sure. And went down and met Michael Hannon, who was the production designer. And originally they were going to have me do set dressing because that's what I had done before. But I told them I was more interested in working outside. My brother was a landscaper at the time down in Saco, and I told him about my brother and that I have grown up in Maine and known a lot about the indigenous plants, and I had read the book several times, so I was really into it. So I got hired right there as the lead greensman, so that was fun.
Man, that is so fascinating, and I love that you decided to try something new out on Pet Sematary as the greensman, and you are literally the creator of, if not the most important character in the movie and in the book, which is the actual Pet Sematary.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how you tackled that?
Sure. Where do I start? Okay, I met with our art department is where the Elks Club in Ellsworth now is, which is beside a hotel, which the company had rented out the entire hotel for all the crew. And then we had the art department. And right down a little dirt road beside, to the right of it, is this field that they had rented from a gentleman whose last name is King, but he's Richard King, but I don't think he's related to Stephen at all. It was just kind of one of those moments. But I met with Mark Hannon and the two art directors, Dins Danielson and Mark Zulski, and they handed me a topographical map and that had the size, shape, and height of the concentric circles written on the map. And they described to me what they were looking at, which was fairly close to the description in the book. And I asked permission to really go by the book. Because Stephen was the screenwriter on that film, so I'd see him every day.
Right.
And not every day, but most days he'd come in while we were working. And so we had a firsthand, if you have that firsthand knowledge right there,
right,
you need to take advantage of it. So I was very nepotistic and hired my brother and a couple of his crew workers from down in the Saco area, and they were fabulous at helping me make this. We brought in, well, it was weird. Okay, at first we walked around the whole area and decided where we were going to put things that would be logical for the generator trucks to get down in. Generator trucks provide all of the electricity for the cameras. And
right, that's important.
And everything. And I met with Crystal, the construction head, who was bringing in a huge plywood piece of a plywood wall, actually. And they held it up with two telephone poles to be the middle part of the deadfall, to support the deadfall and to be able to, it had cutouts of, it sort of looked like a big jack-o'-lantern face on it. And they were cutouts for the lights to go through.
Right.
So we see the shining lights at the title shots. They needed to plant that in first. Then I worked from outside to inside because I had to bring the heavy stuff in. They said, and reading the book, it's really, I think I followed the description fairly well with the big piles of rock that were bordering the deadfall. And then I had my same pulp truck driver come in and bring me, I'd say, 7 to 8 full pulp truck loads of dead wood and stumps. We had one whole load that was stumps because we had to place them. And he was like a painter. This guy could move a tree anywhere I pointed it. It was awesome to behold, but we just started sticking in trees at odd angles so that they would support one another, and then put a stump under a clump and just built the deadfall up first and the large rocks. Then my brother and Ken, his partner, at work, did the concentric circles. We brought in loads and loads and loads of dirt to build the pet cemetery and built the circles, and then we soldered it in. And then I went to Surrey Gardens and probably bought out all of the oriental grasses that they had, because we stuck in dozens. I just wanted it to look as gnarly in person as it did in the images in the book, in my mind. And I did bring Spanish moss and felt kind of sheepish about that because it's not indigenous to Maine.
Oh.
But they want some hangy down bits. So I said, all right, I'll give you some. We had three different raspberry patches from people that lived on the island that allowed me to pick new growth as fast as it sprung up for vines that we put in. And we harvested, oh my gosh, I'd say about 18 bags of moss, cattail moss, reindeer moss, different mosses from in the actual woods.
Mm.
But the coolest thing is my brother was out in the woods walking, and he came upon an actual buried pet.
What?
Ziggy. Yep. This is the freakiest thing, the most incredible thing, because he came back, got a shovel, and he said, we're moving Ziggy to the pet cemetery.
Oh, my gosh. And
I said, really? And he goes, yeah. And there was a little cat collar, and Ziggy wasn't in a bag, so it was just bones. It had been buried there ages ago. So we were very, very careful with Ziggy, and we planted him directly under where Spot, the dog, would have been buried.
No way.
In the dead center of the... No, we did. It was awesome.
Oh, my gosh.
And put his little cat collars on one of the other... It was on one of the other gravestones, but...
Wow, so there's a real pet in the pet cemetery.
Yes, in the remains of the pet cemetery. We had to restore it back to its natural habitat. So when you go there, and I did, I took John Campopiano and Justin White down there to do part of the filming for Unearthed and Untold. And we were down there, and all that's left is the telephone poles, which held the big wall, because we had taken our chainsaws and had to cut that up when we were wrapping the movie. And it was the weirdest sensation for me, because I got to know Fred Gwynn really, really well.
Yeah.
And he liked the same beverages that I liked. As we're walking through, I accidentally kicked something, and it was an old Budweiser can that had been crunched up. And Budweiser was one of the sponsors of the movie, and Fred drank a lot of Budweiser, and it was amazing. I picked it up and I went, oh my gosh, Fred's right here with us, you guys. And they were like, what are you talking about? And I said, Fred would always have a can of beer at the wrap of the day.
Oh my gosh, and that's so freaky.
It is freaky, but it was an awesome feeling.
Oh, I bet.
And his line is, this is a good thing. It's true. The cemetery was a good thing. When you break the barrier of the cemetery, it becomes a bad thing.
Right.
Yeah.
That's so amazing that, you know, maybe that was a sign from Fred when you guys were walking through that day. Oh, that's so fantastic. Oh, my gosh.
I don't think I've ever told anybody that before except John and Justin.
I would definitely encourage our audience to watch their documentary Unearthed and Untold on Pet Cemetery. It is absolutely fantastic. It is a great documentary.
It is. And You'll see me.
Yes.
In all my splendor.
Well, it's amazing that some of the stuff is from the set, from your pet cemetery, it is still there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you can go there and see, you know, some of the remnants from the set, which is really cool.
It was strange because during the wrap out of the film, we had to go back through and restore every set back to its natural, as close as we could get it.
Right.
Natural state. And I put an ad on the radio for anybody to come and take a memento.
Oh, wow.
From set. I had taken Spot, he was a good boy, Here Lies Spot, the slate that we put in there. And incidentally, moss wouldn't stick to that, so that's actually a Brillo pad painted green.
Really?
For the moss. Yeah. I couldn't get moss to stay put no matter what I did on that slate. So we ended up just gluing a Brillo pad on.
Hey, use what you can, right?
Yeah, exactly. But not very many people showed up to take mementos, and had I thought ahead, I would have saved all of it, you know, because nobody working on this film knew it was going to be such a cult following as it is now.
Right.
So, but I was in charge of the, what's called the wrap out sale. All movies have like a garage sale at the end. And we had a big warehouse and a big machine shop in Ellsworth that I ran it out of. We sold all of the furniture and everything out of the pet cemetery, out of the whole movie. So
wow,
that was successful.
Well, that's good. If I had known, like, I could go back in time, I would definitely be there and buy all of it from you.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know.
But
I took a few things that I liked, but
what
yeah.
did you take?
In the flashback sequence where Rachel Creed is seeing her sister, there was a really cool, quirky lamp in the background that was three gargoyles, and the light would come up through them.
Mm.
I took that. I like that piece. I took a crocheted coverlet off of Fred's bed. I sold my brother and sister-in-law the Creed's couch from the living room and the cover of it. This was crazy. I had the grave marker, the slate grave marker in the back seat of my car, and I was getting gas, and a man happened to see it. And he goes, "Oh, is that from the pet cemetery?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Oh, my son is such a freak for that." He said he went to filming almost every day.
Oh.
Could I offer you some money for it? And I said, "No, you can have it."
Oh.
And I'm what a moron I was now, but I was happy that he got it. And I did have some other, like the little pieces of fence that we strung together and stuff that we had gotten. The key pictures, I gave them away to people.
Aww.
Like in the title sequence, when they go around sweeping through the pet cemetery and you see a lot of the individual, like Smucky, he was a good boy.
Right.
All of the grave markers, the stuff that we wrote on them with burnt logs or burnt charcoal bits, were straight out of the book. So those were from Stephen's mind.
There's one thing I love about the pet cemetery are all like the individual knickknacks too that go along
yeah.
with the graves. And you actually went to the dump, right? To find some of those
yeah.
things?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, well, the first time they walked through, usually in a set, like an exterior set, if there's artwork involved, then the art department, painting and set dressing, comes in and they dress it out. Well, the first time that was a walkthrough, the production designer had told me to lay the sod like it was a golf course and make it nice and neat and trim and everything, and I argued with him. I said, no kid in Maine is going to go up and trim down that.
Yeah, true.
Take care of it. I mean, they're going to bury their pet and go there and see what nature has done. and enjoy that, but they're not going to maintain a precise graveyard.
Right.
They're not going to do that. And he goes, how do you know? And I said, I'm a kid from Maine. And I think if you ask any of the Mainers on this crew, they're going to tell you the same thing. And so he and I had an argument. And on every set prior to shooting, they do what's called the walkthrough. And mm-hmm. that's your producers, your director, the director of photography, the gaffer, who is your lighting designer. They all come through and start to plan things. Well, when they came in, it was all in these beautiful primary colors. It did look like a kid with a very artistic eye had decorated this whole huge space. It was 120 feet in diameter. It was a massive set. And Mary Lambert, the director, she's looking around and she's like, shaking her head. And she goes, you did this? I'm standing over. And I said, no, yes. But no, I did the basics. I said, I think that the grass should have been, I should have laid it with it all disjointed so that it all was growing in different directions. I said, because when you move ground, when you dig up ground, you're disrupting the growth of that part of sod. And when you put it back down, rarely do you put the sod in the general direction of the way it was growing. I said, so it would be look unkempt. Mm. And she said, yeah, I agree with you. And so she asked Michael Hannon to step back and let me redo it.
Mm.
And so she gave me one afternoon to redo it.
Wow.
And I said, let's go dump picking, boys, because we wanted to find things that were old, discarded, that kids would go, oh, I can make something out of that. Just like I remember when we were kids and my grandfather said, get out of the house, because we'd stay with them for the summer. And he said, look, find something to build. And we found a whole bunch of boards and we said, we want to build a clubhouse. And he said, have at it. And that was awesome, because when kids are told have free reign, do what you want with it, then they're going to come up with some pretty cool things.
Oh yeah.
So we happened to find a broken oar, and the bird cage was, we actually bent it back to some semblance of a bird cage. We found a broken fish bowl kind of octagonal thing, and we found a fence, and we asked, see, they're off to the left before you go right in to dump your garbage and to go to the sorting place. There was a space at the left of it where the people that worked at the dump put things that people could take if they wanted it. And so I explained who we were and what we wanted, and they said, take it all. And we took most all of it, but and we just started fastening little grave markers with just rope, a couple nails. We did hammer some together, and then I put a note out to the crew on the call sheet to bring in any pictures of their old pets, and we would put them in the pet cemetery. And so we did, and we covered some with Saran wrap, and so that they wouldn't get hurt. And we let get aged with the weather, so we personalized it. And wow. Then when they came back in for the walkthrough, Mary loved it. And we relayed sod, and when we laid it, it was so gnarly. We just stood there ripping up pieces of sod and putting it down like a big puzzle piece. And not only did it make it more fun for us and creative, we got to have a personal touch in it.
Yeah. Did you offer any pictures of any pets in the pet cemetery?
Yeah. I have my cat, Bojangles, and he's featured in one of the title shots. So I have Bojangles was in there. My cat, Missy, was in there. And a dog named Sparkle was in there.
Oh.
So that was fun that I could find those and they got in the movie.
Yeah. Well, what a great way to memorialize them. That's awesome. Yeah.
And we did go out and buy a whole bunch of like leashes and collars and stuff, and then poured a lot of gas on them and lit them on fire. So that was just to age them. So that they would, I know it sounds horrible, but age them really quickly.
Yeah, so. That'll do yeah. it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the houses. Let's talk okay. about the Creed house and the Judd house.
All right.
And Betty and Charles Lewis were actually yep. the owners of both of the houses that were used. What were they like to work with?
Oh, they were actually pretty awesome. Betty was much more outspoken than Charlie was, but Betty was using, she still used the washer and dryer in the small house. She called it the little house, the ranch, that they built Judd's up over. Three-sided facade that, became the bane of our existence one night. You want me to tell you about that?
Yes.
Well, we had filmed already the front of Judd's house, and it took us forever because, well, the paint crew came in and they would put on a layer of paint, a layer of shellac, and heat gun it so that it would crack immediately. And then they put on another layer of paint and another layer. So it was multiple paintings of this house. And I had been dressing the plants and the whole front of it, brought in a giant lilac tree to put on one end of it that would hide for a shot of the window blowing out. Oh, should I say spoilers? Whatever.
It's fine.
because when we shot the blowing out of the window, that Dale's carrying Rachel, the Rachel puppet past.
Right.
That was filmed in June, I think, June or July, very early on in the movie, and they only had that first side done of the house. The remainder of that walk when the house is on fire happened much later, happened towards the end of the shoot in October. But we had worked weeks and weeks on this and got it to where it was looking really nice and gnarly, and kept whittling down the center of his staircase so that it looked like you'd only gone up the stairs in one spot. And the walkway, just trampling down the walkway because it wasn't going to be marked with gravel or anything. Later it had to be because, well, after a few days of filming, Mary comes in and she goes, "Oh, no." I go, "What?" She goes, "I think we made a mistake." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she goes, "We forgot to film the flashback sequence first."
Oh, and no. I said,
"Oh, exactly what I said." "Oh, no." And I said, "When is that scheduled?" She said, "Tomorrow." And I said, "Tomorrow, as in like 24 hours from now?" And she said, "Yeah." She goes, "I'm sorry, it's going to be an overnighter."
And oh, I said, no. Yeah.
So I had to carefully pull out all the plants, hopefully just as they were, to go back in. And the paint crew had to come back, scrape and paint everything. And they had to put in new staircase so that it was all bright, shiny new. And I zoomed over to Surrey Gardens and chose up all their new baby plants so it looked very polished. Mostly I was getting mums that we used for the Gage's funeral. Mm-hmm. And I had some of those still in the warehouse. And man, so we were working through the night. And then I had to go back and plant everything in the morning.
Oh my gosh.
Get it ready for that. One scene that they filmed of Fred as a kid, who happened to be my student later in life.
Oh.
This is so weird, yeah. It's just very weird. Matt Farrell was 10 or 11 when he shot that he was the kid, Judd. And then later on, when I taught at Bangor High School, who walked in my classroom other than Matt Farrell?
Wow.
And I said, "Oh my God, it's a small world." Yeah.
That's crazy.
It is crazy.
And yeah. For that, you guys worked 24 hours to turn the house around and what's in the actual movie.
I know. In the actual movie, it's maybe 2 minutes of footage.
And that, it's like a corner of the house.
Yes, and it is just that one corner. But we did the whole house because she didn't know what they were going to shoot.
Wow.
She doesn't know. She sees it in the morning. And man, that was a long night. And then that afternoon, right as soon as they were done, she was like, well, we need it back to the way it was. And I said, you're going to have to rearrange, because shouldn't we check? We watched the dailies, which is whatever we shot on Monday, we watch on Wednesday. So it has a 2-day turnaround. They sent the film to Boston to be developed. Mm. And then we come back and all the department heads have to sit at the end of their day and watch what was shot 2 days earlier to see if we needed to go back and reshoot anything else. So thank God those came out okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's going to be a continuity issue in any movie.
Yeah.
They happen. But that was a long night for you guys, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was.
Another thing that happened with the Judd facade was that it had to be burnt down for one of the ending scenes. And you guys actually burned down the facade. Mind you, there's a house, 3 feet away from the facade.
Yeah, in some places it was, the structure rested right on the roof.
Wow.
Part of the top structure. It wasn't heavy, but the special effects crew, if you remember in the movie, some of the windows look like they broke out with the flames coming through,
mm-hmm.
but they actually put, I think, 5 or 6 Bunsen burners and tubes of propane going up to them to keep the flame going through the windows. And they covered the small house, the ranch, in, I think it was like a liquid asbestos, but it wasn't dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
It had been developed by the special effects director, Peter Chesney. And he coated it, and they had drywall between the house and Judd's house, and they'd sealed off the interior of the house windows and all the cracks, any possible way that smoke could get in. And I just remember Charlie Lewis looking, they were down to watch it with their lawn chair sitting on the opposite lawn and watching. They had to light the fire through they put rubber cement all the way up the porch and going towards the interior of the house. And I actually have a picture of Jim Fang, who was one of the special effects guys, lighting the rubber cement, the first light, down on it to burn it, because they had to put it out. The paint crew came quickly in. I came quickly in to actually paint and fluff up the plants again, because they had to bring it to fully engulf, put it out, and then do it all over again, so that we had a lot of footage of the burning of the house. And they wanted to slowly burn the front, very front part of it, so that they could get a dolly. There's one shot at the end. They can get a dolly inside in between the two houses and show it burning from the inside out. It's really cool.
Mm.
That shot process. We started in the afternoon of burning it and didn't end until about 10 o'clock that night.
Oh, wow.
Different parts of the house being burnt and different shots being taken. But when Dale Midkiff was carrying the dummy of Denise, that dummy is very heavy, and between probably 50-70 pounds, and he had to carry that from around the back of the house and going across the lawn. And they gave him the path, and the camera gave him the path they wanted him to take. And the first time through, he missed the path because he wouldn't go so close to the house. It's very, very hot.
Right. I mean, it's on fire.
Across the street, you could feel how hot it was. And they had put plexiglass up in between to shield the camera workers. But Dale missed the mark the first time. So after, when they let it burn for a little while and then came back, we had to paint a dark line for him to follow on the grass. So we just painted a little path for him on the grass. And he walked by, but he still, he was so close. He got second degree burns on his left cheek.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he got pretty badly. It looked like a really, really bad sunburn.
Oh,
and
man.
Still, there's a spot right in the film where you know it's happening. He whips his head to the right, exposing all the left side of his face when he's closest to the fire. And he let out a few expletives. They weren't rolling sound on it, so he was cussing up a storm.
Oh,
I don't
man.
Blame
him. Yeah, I don't blame him either.
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy. I mean, hey, Dale Midkiff taking one for the team right there, for real.
Yeah. There was a lot of intrigue around certain sets, more the Mi'kmaq burial ground
yes.
than any other set.
Yes.
That was such a cool set to build and to work on and be there at night when they were filming. Because all film companies have what's called craft service.
It's right.
Where you go to get your snacks. And since we were doing a whole series of night shoots, and it was getting pretty cold because it was getting into the season, like getting fall. And, well, it already was fall. It was like September when we were filming up there. And this was in Sedgwick, was where the Mi'kmaq burial ground was. And it was on top of this huge blueberry barren. And we had to build a bridge to get the trucks over. And so we had to structurally affect the land itself. And there was this massive, massive boulder where the guys come out from behind, which is really cool when they're doing the cherry picker shot, when they're way up in there.
Yeah.
And right along that ridge is a sheer drop off in behind them. And while we were putting the set together, I don't think I've told anybody this either, there was a little bear. My crew was having lunch, and we were just sitting on the burial mound having our lunch, and up comes this little baby bear.
Aww.
And I'm like, oh, exactly. And it was so cute, and it came running over, and I said, don't touch it, because mama's not far behind.
Right.
And just when I said that, because they come up and eat the blueberries. And just as I said that, here comes Mama up over the edge.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, get to the truck. And do you think, had a U-Haul truck. You think we'd be smart enough to get in the cab of the truck? No, we got in the back of the truck.
Oh, no.
And so we had no vision of when the mother was gone, but we heard her eating our lunches, basically. And so when it got quiet, we went back out. And all sweaty and hungry.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she came back a couple times.
Wow.
It was really cool. But the craft service, why I started to say that is because the first night we were shooting up there, the caterers sent up big pots of hot soup for when we have, you have a break midway through 6 hours and then the other 6 hours. So you have a union break. And everybody runs over and eats when they can. And while we were filming, there's this one spot in the film where Judd is lighting a cigarette, and you see Fred, and it's just dusk. And sunset is just almost over, but it was the most stunning sunset. It bathed all the rocks in this pink, peachy color.
Mm.
And Fred actually says, right after he lights a cigarette, he said, cut, and he goes, farmer, that's what he always called me. He said, come here, and he put his arm around me, and I have a picture of that, too. Somebody snapped a shot. He goes, This little farmer made the most fantastic set I've ever worked on. He said, it's truly spiritual. And it was. And just then, that was so nice. But just at that moment, we started hearing, yip, yip, yip. And I went, uh-oh. And he goes, what? And I said, we've got coyotes. And he goes, there's coyotes here? And I said, yeah, they must smell the food. And all of a sudden, there's this, like, whoosh out of the woods that were, well, probably 200 yards away from us, came, like, these five coyotes, and they just ran around the Mi'kmaq once and then took off. It was the coolest thing ever.
Wow.
Like, the whole crew was like, oh, my God, what do we do? I said, don't do anything. They're not going to hurt you. They're just hungry. That's all.
Wow.
And it was just cool. It was one of the defining moments for me. And Fred was like, holy expletive deleted. He was pretty cool. Fred and I had the occasion of going out to Bob the Lobster. I think it's just called Bob's, but he called it Bob the Lobster. On 1A, there was a lobster shack. I don't know if it's there anymore. I'd have to look. But we'd go out there because the owner would find out our shooting schedule and would stay open for 2 hours after we wrapped every day.
Oh, that's cool.
And so it was very cool. We had a lot of really cool locals that would do things like that for us. So we went out there and had a few.
He seems like such an amazing guy. And I know I was reading about his past, and it seemed like, you know, he took this role because he really believed in it, and he had actually lost a child early on.
Yeah.
Was he very connected to the story?
He was. And he would, every time Stephen came on set, he would pick his brain about, there was a lot left out of the movie because you just can't tell everything that's in the book.
Right.
But the connection between Judd and Lewis Creed, Lewis actually saved Judd's wife in the book, and he feels he owes Lewis a debt, and that's why he told him, he said, your daughter's not ready to be parted from her pet, and that's why he told Lewis about the Mi'kmaq burial ground, and a lot of that, and the Mi'kmaq traditions alone that are in the book that Stephen had researched, and we had done some work on that, to dress out the Mi'kmaq. He really wanted to have it be as authentic as possible. He never really liked his own accent that they forced him to do this exaggerated Maine Downeaster accent. He was always worried about that. But Stephen said not to worry about it because the fans will be looking for something like that to hook onto as a main way of life. But Fred was an awesome person, period. He was great.
I love his performance in the Mi'kmaq burial ground too. He has such a presence that he brings when he's on set on the Mi'kmaq. And you actually did a ton of research about Mi'kmaq.
Well, quite a bit. There's Mi'kmaq are more from Quebec, from Canada, and there is a band of Mi'kmaq and Maliseet up in near the French border, but it's a small group of Mi'kmaq, and there's not a lot written about them. They sprang out of the Algonquin. Well, I'm not going to give you a whole lesson on Native American, but suffice it to say, we did study a lot of Native American burial rituals to try to come up with something that was very mystical and spiritual try to be as authentic as we could. And so the fetishes, which a fetish is a spiritual likeness in the form of an animal or parts of an animal, the fetishes that we built on tripods were a combination from the Algonquin Navajo, actually, which is a Western tribe, and the Mi'kmaq. And that most Native tribes believe that the spirit stays within the body for a while. It lingers. and needs to be helped to heaven. And they do that by some ritualistic burning of possessions that was a favorite possessions of the deceased, so that that will help carry them to heaven, the smoke. So we hit up the Acadia Zoo, it used to be back then in Trenton, and if they had animals that had passed, we asked for the carcasses. We also went to taxidermists and got some heads and some bones and other various body parts of animals, and made these little fetishes and hand sewed some leather pouches that we thought would be, which were authentic. They carry a spirit pouch, and then we burnt those over, actually right over the funeral pyres that we made.
Wow.
The rock. So
it's pretty legit.
Yeah, it's a combination though. So if any Native Americans, the Penobscot or Maliseet, I don't want to insult anybody. I never intended that. That's what we were trying to come up with, one form that we could deal with in the movie that was consistent. And we chose the pyre, the stacks of rocks. And so, yeah, let me say here that we intended no insult at all.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love the care and the detail that went into both the pet cemetery and the Mi'kmaq burial ground. It's so detailed. And talking to you, I'm learning so much more about how detailed it was. And it's incredible. It really is. Yeah.
It is the work that you put in.
There's actually another story I meant to ask you about with in the Judd bedroom set. And that's when a police officer came in just to check things out and tell us what happened.
There was these, I mean, we were used to local police dropping by and laughing and checking things up, but these were two state policemen with these big hats, and they came in, and I was there that day for the shoot because we were doing the Teaming from Hell shoot, where at the end, when Dale goes into Judd's house and finds Judd and all the hell that ensues from that, we had to take our chainsaws in and go and bust stuff up and plant about 100 pounds of moss going up the stairs.
Yeah, because it looks really, eerie and gross.
Yeah.
Evil.
Disgusting. Yeah, it was evil. And we were in there shooting, and it was a break time, and the cops came in, and I went over and talked to them and asked them what they were doing. And he said, oh, we just thought we'd check it out. Can you show us around? And so I showed them the set. And then we were walking back behind it, and there's a room, an ante room, where they kept all the dummies. And they would have to keep the faces, well, the eaten away parts of the dummies moist. So the special effects makeup guys, Lance Anderson and David, would go in and squirt the dummies occasionally with mucus and blood. Not real mucus and blood, gelatin, but hey, I brought him in there, and he looks and he goes, oh my God, because the Denise one was covered up to about her neck, and her eyeball was eaten out. And then he saw that and he looked away, and then as he looked away, he looked at the other table where Fred's face is eaten off. Like, oh my God, and he runs out and he goes to the bathroom. I think he was a little bit nauseous that day.
Wow.
So you see the brave strapping men running for the hills. But they're very realistic. I mean, they are right off of their faces and bodies. So yeah, it was creepy.
I asked this question to all of our class of 89 graduates, and it's a personal question, but if you could go back in time, what advice would you give yourself 30 years ago?
Ooh, I think I would say, keep doing what you're doing. Maybe lose some of your attitude. Maybe clean up your language a little bit. I used to be a pretty trash mouth. And actually, I still am, but I just kind of rein it in sometimes. But all in all, I think I'm pretty happy with the work that I did. 30 years kind of freaks me out that time's flying so fast. And I'd do it again. If Steven needed me to do something, I'd work on another movie for him.
Well, fingers crossed that happens.
Yeah, that would be cool.
I loved hearing all of your stories. It's just amazing. It's such a unique perspective on the film. Well, and you created such a huge part of that. You really did. The exteriors are characters in themselves. I mean, the title of the movie is Pet Cemetery, and you created the Pet Cemetery.
Yeah, that was fun. It really was.
What is this place?
This was their burial ground.
Whose burial ground?
Big Mike Indians. I brought you here to bury Ellen's cat.
Why, for God's sake? I said, why, Judd?
I had my reasons.
Thanks for listening to Fangoria Presents Class of 89. We really appreciate you tuning in. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. And follow Fangoria on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the horror content you crave. Class of 89 is a Fangoria Podcast Network original, produced and hosted by Natasha Pacetta, executive producers Dallas Saunier and Phil Nobile Jr., associate producer Jessica Safavimer, art and design by Ashley Detmering, sound recording, design, and mixing by Natasha Pacetta, music by James Malone, for Fangoria, Brandon Wynardi, Jason Koslerich, Rachel Wilson, and special thanks to Udo Kier.